pictures celebrating a love affair that's been going on for 25 years. Los Angeles and KABC. Let's keep on caring. Let's keep on sharing with
Phil Jenkins.
Welcome to another Saturday night on KABC. I am Bill Jenkins, and this is Open Mind, and we want to stretch yours just a little bit. Give you something new to think about. Something very viable to think about that probably will make sense if you think about it. But you're going to have to think differently. And indeed, tonight, you're going to have an open mind. So open it up. I want to read something out of the foreword of a book that kind of caught my attention. Long before man warred with man, the gods battled among themselves. Indeed, it was the wars of the gods that the wars of man began. And the wars of the gods for control of this earth had begun on their own planet. It was thus that mankind's first civilization succumbed to a nuclear holocaust. This is fact, not fiction. And it's all been written down a long time ago in the Earth Chronicles. How about that? A nuclear holocaust? We can even pinpoint the time tonight, and we have the author of the book called The Wars of Gods and Men making an encore appearance on Open Mind with us. Say hello to Zachariah Sitchin. Zachariah, welcome to Open Mind.
Good evening, sir.
The Wars of Gods and Men. Has this been going on all of this time?
Well, it's been going on for a long time. The wars of men certainly are still with us.
Oh, yes, indeed they are. What is it, 38 of them raging right now?
Well, who can count?
Who can count and who can keep up with them? Zachariah, when we first talked to you, we talked about an enormously important book, I thought, called The 12th Planet, and then there has been Stairway to the Heaven. You have been delving into some ancient writings, have you not?
Yes, I've been delving into ancient writings, Bill, and I have spent, I could say, most of my lifetime. I was about to say my adult life, but I thought I'd better say my lifetime because many ask me, how did I happen?
Mm-hmm.
The word is in quotes, you know, happen. How did I happen to get interested in the subject, and how did I come about to do all the research, which, as you can see, and your listeners who have seen the books or read them can see, the immense research that was required for it.
It is extensive.
And it really, Bill, literally takes us back to my childhood, so I can say it was a lifetime, because it all started when I was a schoolboy in what was then Palestine, fortunate to read and study the Old Testament in its original language, which is very important. It makes a great difference. And we reached chapter 6 of Genesis, which is the story of the deluge.
Yes.
And not too many people have noticed, and one reason for that is that many biblical commentators prefer not to notice. They just skip over those verses. But the biblical tale of the deluge of Noah and the ark and what happened is preceded by 8 very enigmatic verses. And the most recalled, the most renowned of them, which is sometimes the subject, favorable subject of Sunday preachers, is that verse that says that those were the days just before the deluge, those were the days when there were giants upon the earth.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very familiar verse. And I, being 8, 9 years old, raised my hand and said, "Excuse me, teacher, but why do you say giants when the word in the Bible, the Hebrew word, is Nephilim, which means those who had come down, presumably from the heavens to earth?" And he said, "Sitchin, sit down. You don't question the Bible."
Don't ask those questions,
right?
Of course not.
But I was not questioning the Bible. I was questioning an interpretation.
The etymology.
That question stuck in my mind. What did the Bible mean by the word Nephilim? Why did it call them Nephilim? Because the Bible the language of the Bible, and I'm talking now about the Hebrew of the Old Testament, is very precise, very precise. And if the Bible called them those who had come down, there was a reason for it. And the answer has developed into three books and hopefully one more.
Well, you touch, well, you more than touch, you get very definitely into the Nephilim in the 12th planet. I noticed that you were going to be speaking out here at one of our really advanced universities, Claire Booth Prophet's Place, where they get into all kinds of things. I heard her give a lecture one night on the 12th planet.
Tomorrow.
And tomorrow we're doing it. Let us just get into that. You'll be talking with Elizabeth Claire Prophet about his discoveries at 3 o'clock tomorrow at Summit University. That's out at 26800 West Mulholland Highway out in Calabasas. And be there if you want to hear more about Mr. Sitchin's fascinating research. They have gotten into it very deeply out at the university.
Yes, I think they have. I think my books are required reading there, if I'm not mistaken.
Actually, her late husband wrote a book that had the very similar theme.
I'm not familiar with it.
I have it at the house, in fact. That was some time ago. Well, it struck me, Zechariah, as we look at your research, that you found some ancient writers, the Sumerians, and all through that period at that time, that were either the greatest science fiction writers of all time, or otherwise they were historians.
Well,
and I have a hard time buying that these ancient gentlemen could come up with rockets and clones and people from other planets and nuclear wars from their point of reference. So perhaps they were historians rather than science fiction writers.
Well, I believe so, Bill, and I hope that I have put together enough evidence. As you mentioned, it is not only written evidence, not only the actual ancient texts, which are very detailed and very effective in bringing to life what they have known or they have seen, but it is also accompanied by pictorial evidence, because the Sumerians, whom you mentioned, who are really the origin of all the so-called mythologies of all the ancient peoples, Greeks included, were also very prolific artists. They are really the inventors not only of many firsts in technology or in literature or in education or in medicine or in concepts of law and justice and so on. They were also the inventors, if you want, of the rotary press, because they used to cut small cylinders about on the average an inch high of very hard stone, sometimes semi-precious stone, and they engraved, nobody yet knows how, they engraved minutely pictorial depictions in reverse as a negative into those cylinders. Then they rolled them on clay, on wet clay, and when the clay dried, you had a permanent record of the positive. So this is really the idea of the rotary press, which we think is a 20th century invention, but that was used 6,000 years ago. And their tales, if we want to call them that, are very detailed. They tell us that people from another planet, which they called Nibiru, meaning planet of the crossing. Its symbol, by the way, was the cross. So the cross, too, is not an innovation going back to the times of Jesus, but preceded Jesus by at least 4,000 years and was the symbol of that planet. They said that there is one more planet in our solar system. They not only named all the planets, some of which, Bill, as you know, we ourselves in modern times have discovered only about 100 or just 50 years ago. Pluto, for example, was discovered about 50 years ago. They knew of all those planets. They described them, how they look. They depicted them in the correct order and in the right relative sizes.
Wonder how they got that information.
Well, this is really the question that answers your question, is it fiction or is it fact? Because they depicted the whole solar system with the sun in the center, by the way, not as the Greeks after them said the earth is in the center. They showed all the planets and one more. And they said that that planet, and they had a cosmology describing how it happened to become a member of the solar system. They said this is the 12th member of the solar system. That's the title of my first book, The 12th Planet. And they said that once every 3,600 years, that planet at its perigee comes at its closest point to Earth, at which time there have been comings and going between Earth and that planet, going back to about 450,000 years ago. So though they lived, their civilization is dated to about 6,000 years ago. They told us about events that happened almost 500,000 years ago. And they, in their text, not only depicted those members of the solar system and how they came into being, they also had, for example, astronomical texts that gave the distances between the planets. Now, you would ask, why do people whom we would consider primitive 6,000 years ago, why would they need to know the distance between Neptune and Pluto? Right. Okay. They called the Earth, as another illustration, they called Earth the seventh planet. Now, we all know, because we went to school, we all know that Earth is the third planet, because from the sun there's Mercury, Venus, and then Earth. Now, who would call Earth the seventh? Only someone who is counting from the outside in, because then they would call Pluto the first, Neptune the second, Uranus the third, Saturn, Jupiter, Mars the sixth, and Earth would indeed be the seventh planet. Now, when someone asked them, as they asked themselves perhaps, how do you know all that? How do you know that there is one more planet? How do you know about all the planets that could not be seen with the naked eye? How do you know that Earth is the seventh? How do you know that there is water out there on the outer planets, things that we are just beginning to find out through the Pioneer spacecraft? How do you know all that? They say, those who came from that planet told us. So it is a complete circle here. If there is such a planet, how did they know about it? They say those who came from it told us.
Right.
Now, if those came and did tell them, then there is such a planet. So either, as you said, it is better than Asimov, right?
Right.
Or it is true.
As I recall when we talked last, that there was some word from the Naval Observatory that the concept of a 12th planet can be accepted.
Yes. Well, the astronomers, and I think I ought to make it clear, the astronomers call this Planet X. And by X, they mean two things. One, X is a mystery planet, a planet we don't know about. Or they mean it X for the Roman 10. Because technically, if you do not consider in the list of 12 the sun and the moon, you have sun, moon, and only 10 planets. So we know about 9, so this would be a 10th planet. The Sumerians, however, considered all these bodies as celestial bodies, members of a solar system. They said there's a sun, there's a moon, which they considered as a celestial body in its own right for reasons that they gave.
Well, many scientists look upon our moon as a tandem planet to us now.
Yes, some think so too now, because indeed, Bill, everything since my book was published at the end of 76, everything that was discovered since then in almost 9 years, be it in astronomy, be it in geology, be it in biology, be it in artificial insemination or in vitro creation of human life, everything confirms. There's been no discovery that contradicts. Everything confirms the Sumerian knowledge.
Well, you have to look at evidence, and you have to look at truth. When you find some scholars that were around 5 or 6 thousand years ago that are talking about things with great accuracy that we don't even know about and are beginning to find out about, and it still holds up as factual,
Then
we have to look very, very hard at it, don't we?
I hope so.
There's an amazing story in your new book, which is published by Avon, by the way, The Wars of Gods and Men. And in just a moment, I'd like for you to kind of give us a little thumbnail sketch and whet our appetite, if you may. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me tonight, and I'm so delighted that he's in studio with us, is Zechariah Sitchin, whose work is monumental in every one of his books. His newest, The Wars of Gods and Men, The Twelfth Planet and Stairway to Heaven are must in your bookshelves, as far as I'm concerned, and I hope you get them all. We'll be back in a second. Celestials, or alien beings, if you want to call them that, from another planet, who had a very profound impact upon the formation of human life as we know it, as far as that goes on this planet, and certainly our societies. Some of their problems and wars got carried over to our planet and among our people, and we have picked up that warlike attribute of theirs. I wish we had left that one along the way, but I guess it was sort of inherited. But
yes, it was. Bill, before the break, you asked me to try and sum up.
Yeah. Give us the fascinating thumbnail sketch, because I know the audience is going to want to know more.
Well, I'll do my best, because it took many years to write it, and there are many pages and many illustrations to
I'm always doing
read
that. I want you to put 12 years of work into 2 minutes.
In 12 minutes, right. Anyway, as you said in your introduction, those who had come to Earth, and at this point, I think we can assume that the listeners are at least going along with us, that beings from another planet in our own solar system had come to Earth about 500,000 years ago.
But if we want to point out again that this is not something fanciful that you have conjured up in your mind. This is the information that you're getting from the ancient Sumerians and other ancient texts and writings that are found.
Including the Old Testament.
Including certainly that one. So it's not fantasy here. It very well could be historical data. And that's the way I want you to look at it.
Right. So they came here, and the first point to be borne in mind is that they came here for their own reasons. They also did not come here because they were traveling from A to B and crash landed here, or just happened to pass by this small speck of dust we call Earth in universal terms. They came here for a purpose, because on their planet, they were facing extinction. The reason was, and here I must distinguish between what is written in the text and what I surmise from them. I surmise that their problem was that they were losing atmosphere on their planet. And in order to keep it, in order to retain what they had, their scholars, their scientists discovered that if they could suspend gold particles and create like an envelope of gold particles around their atmosphere, they could go on surviving on their planet. Now, they have found out that there is gold on Earth, on this so-called seventh planet. And the story of how that happened is told in a text that, again, was originally written down for the first time by the Sumerians. The reason it was written down the first time by them is that they were the first ones to have writing.
Mm-hmm.
But we found it, our scholars and archaeologists have found it, principally preserved in a Hittite version. The Hittites are the ancient peoples of Anatolia, of what is today Turkey. And the tale is one of a usurpation of powers, of a revolt on their planet, where the then ruler was deposed by someone called Anu, and that deposed ruler escaped in a spaceship. The description leaves no room for a doubt that he escaped on a spaceship from their planet, Nibiru, to what the text, the Hittite text says, to dark Yud Earth. This is how Earth looked at them from space, as a dark Yud planet.
We found out it does look like that.
And he discovered that there's gold on Earth. And in order to come back into good graces, or maybe in order to survive, the evidence which I bring out in my new book, The Wars of Gods and Men, is that both he and his descendants, especially his grandson, were reinstated into some position of influence because of his discovery. And about one orbit of their planet, which is about 4,000 years, about one orbit later, when they again were in a position to come and go between their planet and Earth, a mission to Earth came from their planet. The leader of that mission is named in the text. His name, his title, was Enki, which meant Lord Earth. He splashed down in the waters of the Persian Gulf, and the splashing down is described. Their garb as fishmen, if you want to use the term, is described even pictorially. He led a party of 50. They waded ashore. They found a spot at the head of the Persian Gulf. They found there, if you want to call it, Earth Station 1. They called it Eridu, which literally meant home away from home. And all the names that we have today for our planet, which in English is Earth, or in German, Erde, come from that word, Eridu.
Is that right? Eridu.
And then the story goes on.
Can you hold the story for just a second?
Okay.
Because we have to do something. It's fascinating. And let me remind those that are with us to get your questions ready for Zechariah. But I do want to hear the rest of that, but you know how it is around here. Was it Jim's new book? It's out on Avon. Zechariah is sitting right here with us in the studio and was in the process of giving us a thumbnail sketch, and you had me on the edge of my seat there. Continue.
Okay, thank you, Bill. So this is, Bill, how they happened to come to Earth for a purpose in search of gold. And that the beginning of that was a conflict on their planet. This is important to remember. Now, when the first efforts to obtain the gold by distilling the waters of the Persian Gulf failed, they faced the key problem of whether to abandon the whole project and thus perhaps accept their own extinction on their planet, or to resort to other means of obtaining gold.
Now, they wanted the gold to suspend in the air to form more or less a greenhouse effect,
right,
over their
right,
planet. It's
right.
Amazing that the ancient Sumerians would know about a greenhouse effect.
Well, one of many amazing things.
Yes, right.
So they decided to do it the hard way, and they went into a mining operation in southern Africa. And by the way, in one of my books, I forget now which one, I do mention that archaeologists in South Africa have discovered evidence that their mines were worked 30, 40, 80,000 years ago, way before anybody we can imagine would have done that. And in order to carry out this mass scale operation on Earth, 900 of them were sent to Earth. 600 landed on Earth, again in groups of 50. 300 operated space stations and shuttlecraft, which collected the refined ore and would then transfer it periodically to a mothership that would take it to their planet. in charge of that operation, the supreme commander on Earth, was another son of the ruler who usurped the powers of Anu, and his name, his title, his epithet was Enlil, which meant Lord of the Command, Commander-in-Chief. Now, the two of them, Enki and Enlil, were half-brothers. If we have time tonight, I'd like to go at some other point into this whole question or aspect of half-brothers and half-sisters, because many things that we have done or that the biblical patriarchs have done and the rules they lived by stem from that. But anyway, this fact that two half-brothers, both contending for the right to be the one to inherit the throne on their planet, that both of them came to Earth, one a scientist, a metallurgical expert, a genius in construction, to whom the construction of the pyramids of Giza has to be attributed and not to any pharaoh, and the other a commander, a military man, a tough guy. His epithet was the bull. He's even depicted as a bull.
You needed both these personalities in order to carry out this mission.
So you have these two different leaders, half brothers, both contenders for the succession to the throne on their planet. They both end up on this small planet. And thus, the conflicts, the rivalries, even the rivalry for the love of their half-sister, they both had the same half-beautiful half-sister, who was the chief medical officer on Earth. All that has developed in time, we're talking about half a million years, into what I call the Pyramid Wars. There were two of them. One was more localized, one was almost a global war. And then this conflict, once they made peace, carried in to their sons, because each one of them had a son. And then the sons were the contenders. And that contention between the two sons of the two leaders led in the year 2024 BC, precisely 4,000 years ago, to the use of nuclear weapons on Earth. So in a few weeks, actually, I think it's August 6th, we would be marking what we think is the 40th anniversary of the first use ever of atomic weapons on Earth, when an atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. But it's not so. It is 4,000 years. And this is really what the book, the new book, The Wars of Gods and Men, picks up this story from the point of view of the rivalries, because each book can be read independently, because each book tells the story, though it brings it ever closer to our time. This last book ends with the days of Abraham, who was Abraham, and what was his role in those earth-shaking events.
So the first nuclear holocaust was 2024 B.C.
Right, 4,000 years ago, not 40 years ago.
Where was it?
The weapons, and there were seven weapons. The details, Bill, if somebody would read the text I'm quoting, are so vivid. It's as if a reporter from your station, from ABC, was witnessing and was reporting. The tremendous flash, seven weapons were used, seven devices. The tremendous flash, the mushroom cloud, the darkness that followed the brightness, and the spread, this gradual spread of the mushroom, of the nuclear cloud, carried by the prevailing winds eastward from the shores of the Mediterranean Sea, from the Sinai Peninsula, gradually towards Mesopotamia, bringing to an end, to an abrupt end, the Sumerian civilization. It took 70 years for Mesopotamia, for the land to come out of the poisoning. The waters was poisoned. All the plants withered. All life perished. It took 70 years for Mesopotamia to be habitable again, just from the nuclear cloud, not from the explosions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the process of exploding those devices over the Sinai Peninsula, and the reason they did it was that there was a spaceport there, in the process, another area, which was considered an area of sinful cities, and why they were considered sinful is explained in the Sumerian text, that was the event of the upheavaling, to use the biblical term, of Sodom and Gomorrah, which Abraham witnessed.
Mm-hmm.
So it all happened
at
the same time in the year 2024 B.C.
And those lands prior to that, or at least as you study those lands, they were once very fertile and green.
Very fertile.
And they really haven't recovered from that Holocaust then at all?
No, that area in the south of the what is called the Dead Sea, or in the Bible the Salt Sea, was flooded. Because the barrier at the southern end of the Dead Sea was breached by the explosions, and the waters after the seven cities were wiped out, the waters flooded that area. But there is still radiation in that area to this day, after 4,000 years.
Do we have any idea of how large the devices were that were used?
Well, there are NASA photographs, which unfortunately we can't show your listeners now, but I reproduce them in the book,
mm-hmm.
that from space, you know, from a spacecraft, that show an immense crater where the spaceport, I claim, was, and the cracks that run through almost half the peninsula as a result of those explosions. So the power must have been tremendous. And to this day, the plain, there's a plain there, is strewn for miles on end with broken up pieces of blackened stone, for which no scholar, no scientist has an explanation. How could an area of miles and miles around be covered with broken up stones, all black?
One of the things they probably won't accept is a theory that there was a nuclear explosion there.
Well, let them then explain the crater.
Explain it some other way.
Right.
Well, as you can see, we're off for a journey tonight in the mind, you and I, with Zachariah Sitchin, who is here. His book is called The Wars of Gods and Men. You've gotten just a touch of it. It's fascinating. But the thing of it is, it's not something Zachariah made up. It's something that he found in the ancient text. And as we pointed out earlier, they were really terrific science fiction writers with a grip on the future that is unreal. Or they were very good historians. And to go along with you, Zachariah, that
Thank
it was
you.
The latter, that they were historians. And we'll be back and we'll start talking to you. You ready to field some questions? Because I know you've probably generated a few among the better interrogators of this show, and that's the audience.
Fine.
Ready?
We'll
be back to that in just a moment. Welcome to Open Mind.
Yes, good evening, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask your guest if he's familiar with the work of Erich von Däniken, who wrote a few books years ago based on the Chariot of the Gods theory. And I was wondering, if so, does his theories tend to reinforce Mr. von Däniken's? Because his theories were that there were extraterrestrial visitors as well.
Well, the answer to your question is yes. Now, to go into somewhat greater detail, I think I could best answer it in the following way. Soon after my first book was published, I was invited to share podium with Mr. von Däniken at some a conference. That event was preceded by a press conference. I came to the room where the press conference was being held. That was the first time I ever met Mr. von Däniken, and he me. In front of all the newsmen and reporters that were gathered there, he came towards me. He embraced me. He turned to the newsmen and said, "Well, you people keep writing that I don't know what I'm talking about. But here is the man who proves me right.
So you two are of like minds there in many, many areas. Does that answer your question, Dwight?
Yes, thank you.
All right. Thank you for your question. It was a good one. We'll be back in just a moment. Here, Barbara, hello.
Hi, good evening, Bill.
Right.
I was curious to know where Mr. Sitchin's books were available in the Los Angeles area.
Well, they should be available in all bookstores, and if the one that you go to, it's not there, just insist that they order it.
And, we'll get as much of Margaret's question in as possible. All right, Margaret, what's up?
It's Margaret.
Margaret.
Which, I don't know if it makes any difference or not.
I'm not wearing my glasses. So
no, well, all right, so I'm not hearing your whatever. my question was, and I believe I heard your guests say, the people, and I assume they are in people form, though I'm not sure of that, came here and were looking for gold. Now,
there's our music.
Yeah, I hear that.
Right.
I would like to continue that.
I want you to stay right on there if you don't mind sitting.
I would love to.
Because that's what he said. And we'll let him elaborate on that just a little bit more. It's Open Mind tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins, and delighted to have in studio with me Mr. Zachariah Sitchin, the author of The Wars of Gods and Men. And that's what we're talking about tonight. Get your questions ready. We have two more hours, so come on in. Open Mind tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins, and with me in studio, Zachariah Sitchin. And we're talking about book three of his Earth Chronicles called The Wars of Gods and Men. And as you've been listening, we're not talking about science fiction. Or if we are, we're talking about some elaborate science fiction that was written over 6,000 years ago, in which they talked of nuclear holocaust and flying ships and spaceports and things that I defy you to say that those people could have thought of on their own. Most likely they were historians. And we had Margaret on the line who wanted to know about the matter of gold entering into this scenario. Margaret, let's continue.
Yes, because to me gold is sort of so earthbound, I wondered why they would indeed want it.
Well, wow, you weren't listening, Margaret.
Well, I guess I wasn't.
Okay.
So explain it to me simply. I'm a very simple person.
Okay, in simple terms, they did not come here for gold, for jewelry, or for any other such purpose, you know, frivolous purpose.
Yes.
They came here because they needed the gold for their survival on their own planet.
In what way? What would they need the gold for?
Well, okay.
I mean, I'm just asking.
No, no, it's okay, because obviously others heard me and you didn't, but their planet has a vast elliptical orbit.
Mm-hmm.
Goes very far out in space and once in 3,600 years comes into the vicinity of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
They developed a problem on their planet that their atmosphere was eroding. They were losing their atmosphere and thus were at the risk of being perishing on their planet.
Mm-hmm.
They have discovered, their scientists have discovered, that if they would suspend gold particles in their atmosphere, they would create a sheath, a covering, to protect their atmosphere and their planet. And as Bill said before, they would create a greenhouse effect that would also help them retain the heat generated by their planet.
Mm.
And thus they came here in search of gold, having discovered, and I also told how they happened to have found out that there is gold on Earth. They came here for that purpose. Their survival depended on it. They did not need it for jewelry.
No, I'm sure not. I simply wondered
why.
Well,
I don't know. As a woman, why are you sure not?
Pardon me?
As a woman, why are you sure they did not come here for jewelry?
Well, now that just smacks of the earth, my dear. Not another planet. I hope there aren't other male chauvinists out there.
As a matter of
Bill.
As a matter of fact, some of their leaders were women. And if Bill will let me, I'll tell you a little about it.
Well, I would like to say to Bill, this man has an awful lot of earthbound qualities to him. I'm sorry. That was not my intent. As a matter of fact, I was thinking of gold fillings, if anything.
Oh. Margaret, but I hope that answers your question.
Well, indeed it does, and it also answered my other question, which was gold per se, and jewelry was not my idea of it.
Okay.
You know, there's a heart of gold.
We were kind of joshing with you a little bit there, Margaret.
Well, and I'm joshing with you too, you know.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to call you back, Bill.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Thank you very much. We have a lot of fun with our gang out there. Okay, Donald.
Hi, how are you, Bill, tonight?
Right.
Two questions. One, if these people were viewing from outer space onto Earth, why was such importance given to the Earth moon and all the moons of the other planets ignored? Wouldn't they see those from a different viewpoint, too?
Well, you said you have two questions.
Yeah. What's Can we try that one or not?
Well, it's up to Bill.
Go right ahead and answer whatever.
Okay. Now, according to the Sumerian cosmology, the moon was in the process of becoming a celestial body, a planet in its own right. That is why it was considered to be a 12th member of the solar system, unlike the other moons or moonlets of which we know. Another one that was a moon of another planet and became a planet itself is Pluto. This is a theory that most astronomers today subscribe to, but which is described by the Sumerians in their writings 6,000 years ago. So there were two celestial bodies, one that became the planet Pluto, and one was our moon, which they called Kingu, which was in the process of becoming a planet, but due to celestial collisions and other events, which they described and I described in my first book, The 12th Planet, it didn't become a planet on its own right, but they still considered it to be a celestial body in its own right, nevertheless.
So just those two, Pluto might have been a moon, and our moon were the only two important ones.
Right.
The other moons were unimportant.
The other moons remained the satellites of other planets, and therefore they were not in the same category.
Okay. If the desert goes from the Mediterranean, would it include the Gobi Desert? Would it go all the way to China? And then my question is, did the Chinese give any accounts of these incidents?
Well, the prevailing winds carry the nuclear cloud from the Sinai Peninsula, from the shores of the Mediterranean Sea, towards Mesopotamia. Beyond Mesopotamia, there are the mountains, the Zagros Mountains, which would protect the area leading into what is today Iran, or formerly known as Persia, India, and so on. So how far the cloud went on, I do not know, because I'm relying on the Sumerian writings, and since their civilization perished as a result of that cloud, they were not allowed to write and tell us more. Now, the Chinese civilization came much, much later, because we are talking about people, the Sumerians, who started to write and build high-rise buildings, seven-story buildings, and have law courts and courts and even juries, by the way. 6,000 years ago, and the Chinese civilization, as far as we know, is much younger. So I cannot really answer you whether or not this nuclear cloud was carried as far as China.
Does that help you, Donald?
Okay, fine. Thank you.
For those who may have just tuned in, you missed the first hour in which we talked about the fact that in the year 2024 B.C., that there was quite a nuclear war in what would now be centered in what is now the Sinai Peninsula.
Right.
And created a great deal of damage. And this information and the descriptions of the nuclear war and the blast and the radioactive cloud is all caught up in the ancient Sumerian text of which Zechariah Sitchin, who's our guest tonight, has written a book called The Wars of Gods and Men. And if you just joined us, settle in, because we're going to pull your string just a little bit tonight. And we invite you to call in and talk to Zechariah if you want to. Let me give you a couple of the numbers in Los Angeles, 520-TALK. San Fernando Valley, you're number 990. San Gabriel Valley, you're 448. And I'll be right back with Zechariah in just a moment. We're talking about his new book, The Wars of Gods and Men. By the way, Zechariah, you're going to be appearing tomorrow.
Yeah.
Yeah, do you want to tell us where and all about that?
I'll be lecturing and having discussions with Elizabeth Clare Prophet at the Summit University tomorrow at 3 o'clock. The address is 26800 West Mulholland Highway.
Mulholland Highway.
Calabasas.
Way out there, but it's worth going out there to see you and hear all about it in person.
Well, they can hear me tonight, but they can't see me tonight, unfortunately, right? And I'm reading here that for information, one could call 818-880-5300.
All right. And we'll give you that information a couple of other times. Zachariah's book is Avon, available all over.
May I mention a competing station?
You certainly may.
Monday morning, I'm on the mid-morning LA show on Channel 9.
Mm-hmm. With our good friend Jeff Edwards. And they'll treat you right over there.
Thank you.
And Miss McCrae, she's also there. Meredith. We have Bob on the line. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Bill. Hello, Zachariah.
Good afternoon. Good evening. I'm just flew in from New York, so.
Okay.
He doesn't know what time of day.
Right.
Okay. Bill, are you familiar with the Rye maps of Alexandria, Egypt?
I thought I was pretty familiar with Egyptology, but that one escapes me. The Rye maps? How do you spell it?
R-I. Re or Rye.
Map?
Mm-hmm.
A map? An actual map?
Yeah. Basically, from what I've gathered was that these were copies.
Wait
from
a minute.
Previous
maps. I think you're talking about the Reis map. R-I-I-S.
Okay.
Right. Which was found originally in Asia Minor in Turkey.
Yes.
And it seems to delineate the American continent and Antarctica when it was not covered by ice, right?
Yes.
Yes.
And its center was located in the similar area to where you said that spaceport earlier was.
Yes.
I was wondering if the Sumerians had any reference or correlation to the Egyptian maps and how they would be connected together, because the Egyptians have always been associated with the gods and stuff like that, just like the Sumerians.
Yes, I can recommend to you a terrific book which will answer that question in detail.
Okay.
That's my book. It's titled The Wars of Gods and Men. And the previous one, The Stairway to Heaven, which bring into the total picture, because it is, as you say, one tale, one story and one history, brings into the picture and correlates with the Sumerian tales and civilization, the Egyptian mythologies, the pyramid texts and so on. And the Sumerians definitely were aware of the pyramids. They were aware of the Egyptian beliefs, and indeed the Egyptians said that their gods have come to Egypt through the Red Sea from a place called Urta. Urta is taken to mean the ancient or the olden place, but the name Ur, or Er as it many pronounce it, should strike a bell, because that was one of the principal cities in Mesopotamia, in ancient Sumer, and the one from which Abraham came. So the Egyptians knew that their so-called gods had come from Mesopotamia, and they were one and the same as the Sumerian ones.
Okay, thank you very much for the information.
You know,
I listen all the time.
All right, thank you very much, Bob. Appreciate that.
Bye.
More and more, it seems, whenever we're talking about the ancient text and the ancient writers, even the writers of the Bible, when they talk about gods, they're not talking about gods at all. They're talking about other mortal human beings.
Yes, well, they were in a way considered immortal, and that needs some explaining. But the ancient peoples, Bill, did not call them gods at all. This is a term that I use simply because that's how people have come to learn the gods of Egypt, the Greek gods, Zeus and Aphrodite and so on. The Greeks were the first ones that coined the term Deus, which is an Indo-European word, which meant, by the way, the shiny one. Also not God. But this is where we got this concept of God with the lowercase g.
Mm-hmm.
The Sumerians called them Anunnaki, which literally meant those who from heaven came to earth, which takes us back to the meaning of the word Nephilim in the Bible. And the Old Testament, in other chapters of the book of Genesis and even later on, says that the Nephilim were the same and part of the Anakim. And as I explain in my latest book, Anakim was simply, it's taken to mean giants again, was simply the Hebrew for Anunnaki, the Sumerian word. So these are the ones who from heaven came to earth. The Egyptians called, the so-called gods of Egypt, called them Netero, which means the guardians. So none of the ancient peoples, the Babylonians called them Elo, which meant the lofty ones. None of them used the word God. It is only a concept that we have acquired from Greek words, Greek terminology.
All right. And we are going to get into a good deal more of that with you and Zachariah Sitchin tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. Based on his own personal experiences to teach people to experience expanded states of awareness, including the out-of-body state. We talk about that a lot here. The Gateway Weekend Workshop is a 3-day workshop. Now, the next that will be given is July 26th, 27th, and 28th. Robert Monroe, who will be a guest on the show again here in a few weeks, has developed a patented process called HemiSync. It's been determined that certain audio pulse frequencies, when heard through stereo headphones, will create expanded states of awareness. This process is used in the Gateway Weekend Workshop. Now, if you'd like more information, and I hope you do, call area code 213-393-9405. Monroe also offers a home study course of cassette tapes. To get more information on the Gateway Weekend Workshop or on the cassette tapes, call area code 213-393-9405. And they're ready to talk to you right now. Or attend their free lecture on July 18th. Call for more information, area code 213-393-9405. We're 28 minutes past 10 on this Saturday night. It's Open Mind with me, Zachariah Sitchin. His book, The Gods of Wars and Men. And Dan is on the line. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Bill. Hello, Mr. Sitchin. Mr. Sitchin, I'm particularly interested in the pyramid forgeries that you wrote about in The Stairway to Heaven.
Yes.
And I also wrote to you regarding that. Thank you for your kind response, sir. And regarding those forgeries, I'm curious as to whether academic archaeology is doing anything to investigate the forgeries or your hypothesis.
Well, let me tell you this first of all. In The Stairway to Heaven, which you mentioned, I arrived at the conclusion that the inscription attributing the construction of the Great Pyramid of Giza to the Pharaoh Cheops, or Khufu in Egyptian, was actually a forgery perpetrated in 1837 by a British colonel by name of Howard Wisey, or his assistant, a fellow called Hill. That conclusion was reached by me based on a lot of evidence from that time and from research done by me afterwards at the British Museum. And that is where I left it. In other words, it was like a detective effort to show who the culprit was, and I left it at that. What you may not know, or others who have read the book, which was published in 1980, you may not know, is that about less than 2 years ago, I received a letter from an engineer in Pittsburgh. And he wrote to me and said, Mr. Sitchin, I read your book, The Stairway to Heaven, and what you say about the forgery in the Great Pyramid has been known in my family for the past 150 years. When I read that, I, you know, was flabbergasted. I called him by phone, and I said to him, Mr. Allen, what do you mean it has been known in your family for 150 years? How could that be? Well, he said, here's the story, and afterwards he sent me family records to support what he said. He said his great-grandfather was a master mason in England and went to Egypt at the time that Howard Vyse was there in order to help build an eye hospital for the Egyptians who were working for Colonel Vyse inside the pyramid. That plan did not materialize for various reasons, which Vyse also mentions in his diaries, and therefore that Master Mason was asked or offered a job by Mr. Vyse to work inside the pyramid because Vyse was getting desperate for some kind of a discovery, having spent 2 years and the family fortune searching inside the pyramid, finding nothing. And Vyse decided to use gunpowder to blast his way through the pyramid to what he thought were secret or hidden chambers. They did find so-called chambers of construction, which had a different purpose entirely, some mentioned by me in the second book, some in the new book. And those chambers of construction had a few markings, according to Vyse there, which he showed to the British consul in Cairo and the Austrian consul, and they crawled in and signed a document, a facsimile of those writings that supposedly spelled the name of Khufu, and lodged them in the British Museum. I, by the way, was the only one in 150 years that asked to see that, and it took some time at the museum to find it for me. Now, my conclusion was that those erroneous hieroglyphics done by an amateur were really painted by Mr. Hill, and I pinpointed the night in which he went in to do that with paint and brush. The great-grandfather of the gentleman from Pittsburgh witnessed it and wrote to his father in England and said, I saw Mr. Hill go with brush and paint on the pretext that he was going in to make more legible signs that were there, but in fact he was writing new signs and forging the name of the pharaoh. That great-grandfather wrote it to his father. After that he was fired by Vyse and never permitted to come back to the pyramid. Those letters from Egypt were part of the archives that the family took to the United States when they migrated from England to upstate New York, and that gentleman from Pittsburgh knew of them, saw them, recorded the tales of the family of his mother and his aunt about those letters and the incident, and thus there appeared about 2 years ago literally an eyewitness to the forgery, an eyewitness to something that happened 150 years ago.
That's absolutely fascinating. And I think if academic archaeology ever gets around to the business of investigating it, this is really going to rock the basis of Egyptian chronology, isn't it?
Well, not of Egyptian chronology, but of the assumption that Khufu built the Great Pyramid, that his successor built the second large pyramid, that their successor built the third one, and so on. That definitely does not hold water anymore.
I have one more question, if I could ask it. Mr. Sitchin, have you also considered an alternative interpretation of history, one that might include past high civilizations that are of Earth origin, like the Atlantis myth or the Lemuria myth?
Well, I did not have to consider it because we know of it. Because according to the Sumerian texts and according to the biblical version, a much shortened version of those texts, there was a civilization on Earth quite advanced. At least they knew of metallurgy, they knew of musical instruments, just to give a few examples of what that civilization had. And that existed before the deluge. Now, the deluge, according to my sources and calculations, happened about 12 to 13,000 years ago, which is at least 6-7,000 years before the Sumerian civilization, which was a post-diluvial civilization. So the Sumerians themselves and the Old Testament, quoting the same original sources, do tell us of a civilization even before the deluge, which was, of course, wiped out by the deluge.
Have you, if you're interested in Atlantis, have you read Charles Berlitz's book on it?
Yes, I have. Very interesting, Bill.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right, Dan.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Appreciate the question. And we're 36 minutes past the 10 o'clock mark, about the halfway mark on our night with Zachariah Sitchin and his new book, The Gods of War and Men. And Ben, you're on.
Zachariah?
Yes.
Two quick questions. Did any of these alien people remain on Earth? And are their descendants here amongst us now?
Well, you want to know more than I say in my books.
Well, but that's absolutely. I'm talking about your next book.
That's right. Give me a chance to write it.
Okay, you're a
psychic person, Ben.
But what do you think, Zachariah, or would you rather pass on that question?
Well, let me give you a clever answer. In a way, we are all descendants of them. That is your second question.
Okay.
Because the story that comes out of the Sumerian writings of the depictions is that when they came here and when they had to resort to the onerous task of getting their gold through mining and no longer through a sophisticated process, just by processing the waters of the Persian Gulf. At some point, which is described in the first book, those who were working in the mines mutinied. The description, by the way, Bill, of the mutiny is so vivid, it's as if somebody is describing the the march on the Bastille in France, with the torches, with what was burned down, how they surrounded the home of the commander and really kept him in house arrest until he agreed to their demands.
Now, the people that were working in the mines, were they from the other planet?
Yes, they were part of the 600 who landed on Earth.
That's when they started making people.
Right. Now, the solution that they found, and again, the solution was offered by Enki, who was the scientific leader, to the problem, because those who were here refused to continue mining. They had to get the gold for their survival. So he said, there is a being on Earth which already exists. Those, by the way, Bill, are the words of the Sumerian text.
Mm-hmm.
The being already exists. All we have to do is to put on it our imprint so that it could do the work for us.
Uh-huh.
And what they did was they took ape men, ape women, who were already on Earth through evolution. And through genetic manipulation, which is described again in great detail and even in pictures, which I reproduce, they jumped the gun on evolution. In other words, I believe that we, Homo sapiens, would have evolved on Earth anyway, but in another 5 or 10 or 20 million years. They jumped the gun, mixed their genetic material with that of ape woman, with the egg, fertilized the egg of ape woman, exactly, by the way, in a process that is now is called in vitro.
That's right.
And created about 300,000 years ago us. They created Homo sapiens.
That makes sense.
So in a way, we are all descended of them, and that is what the Bible means by saying that we were created in there. By the way, the Bible uses the plural, not the singular. In their image and in their likeness.
Okay.
In their image physically and in their likeness mentally, morally, spiritually.
That's interesting. Second question. In your opinion, what does this all do to all the religious belief systems of a supernatural God, one person who created everything, in your opinion?
I think it upholds it.
It upholds a single God?
Of course.
Since, that means, in what way does that do that? It's kind of interesting. How does that uphold a God that created Earth when we know that these people came from another planet?
Well, sir,
I suppose
you wouldn't, you know, take it amiss if I say, please read my books.
I will, absolutely.
Okay, because I end the first book, The 12th Planet.
Uh-huh.
I end it with the question, which, if Bill would lend me the copy, I'll read it to you.
Okay.
Now, the Bible called them, if you were tuned in before, Nephilim. The Sumerians called them Anunnaki. The Bible called those who came here Nephilim. And I explained how they, in quotes, created men, really did not create us, just advanced us genetically.
Uh-huh.
And the very last sentence in my first book is the following. And I quote, "And if the Nephilim were the gods," in quotation marks, "who created," in quotation marks, "men on Earth, did evolution alone on the 12th planet create the Nephilim?" Question mark.
Very good.
In other words, there is a cycle, there is an endless process, and to think in terms, in religious terms, only as if there is a God that belongs only to this Earth, to
right.
this planet, I don't think this is... The right belief. But if one says there must be a universal creator, one who may have preordained everything, one who created them and through them us, that, I think, is the answer to
your question. I think we can add one more thing to that, Ben, that when you look at the Old and New Testament, that the term which we refer to God, the creator of the universe, appears only twice. And that's in the first chapter of Genesis.
Is there any mention?
And from then on, it's mentioning something else, which is human in origin.
Right. Is there any mention of these people believing in God?
Well, what we know, what the Sumerians know, was the key to them and to us by them. So our beliefs are really their beliefs.
Okay, very good, and thank you kindly.
I want to fortify you just a little bit more on that, Ben. There's a book called The Genesis Mystery, and which it deals with anthropology. But suddenly, in a geological twinkling, there did appear on this planet what we would call the Cro-Magnon man, who for a while, in fact, coexisted with the Neanderthal man. And you have people like Dr. Crick, who discovered the DNA molecule, Jeffrey Goodman, who wrote that book, and another rather esteemed and highly held anthropologist, who call this the intervention.
Right.
And say by no way could this have happened by Darwinian evolutionary processes.
Right, okay. Thank you kindly.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you for your question. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me tonight, Zachariah Sitchins. 2 years has already resulted in the death of over 430 Americans, the destruction of half of our corn crop, and probably the marvelous weather we're enjoying right now can be attributed to the bending of the jet streams. You'll find the science behind it, how it's done, where it's coming from. The Weather War with Tom Bearden. 2 weeks from tonight. But right now we have Zachariah Sitchin with us. We're talking about The Wars of Gods and Men. It's his latest book, his third book in a series called The Earth Chronicles. And it's a fascinating story that tells us of the first nuclear holocaust, 2,024 years before Christ. And that ought to get your attention. Let's see if it's gotten Carol's attention. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have a question for Mr. Sitchin. Now, in his first book, he says that he talks about Enki, and later he tells us about his son Marduk. Now, in the last book, he still talks about Enki as living, and Marduk is living, and that's about 450,000 years. So, what I would like to know is, are Enki and Marduk still living? And if they are they living on this planet? And if they are, where?
A good question that gives me a chance to answer something that I think Bill wanted me to say, but we were interrupted by a commercial break. interfering with history. It did take, as far as we count the years, let's say almost 500,000, roughly, give or take, a few thousand years, from the landing until the time, say, of Abraham of the nuclear holocaust, which I deal with in the third book. And you're right in pointing that out. I could even say that you must assume, as I did, that Enki, if he were chosen to lead the first landing party on Earth, he must have been already somewhat mature even then, 20 years, 30 years old, etc. Now, what is a year that we call a year? A year is really the time that the planet on which we live and on which we were born, the time it takes that planet to orbit around the sun, right?
Right,
that's
I know.
1 year.
You explained that in the first book.
Yeah, I know, but I'm answering questions from the 1,300,000 listeners, as I understand, are listening to us this moment, and not just to you. So, to them, 1 year was really the time it took their planet to orbit around the sun. In our terms, it is 3,600 Earth years. But to them, it is just 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So, the, let's say, 360,000 then flies in our apartment, which is here in Saturn especially, would say the following. Father fly would tell baby fly or son fly. He says, you know, this Zechariah Sitchin is immortal because my father told me that his father told him that as long as our family flies can remember, Sitchin was always around and he always looked then the way he looks now. So this whole notion that came out especially in the Greek tales, the Greeks sometimes referred in the tales of Homer to the so-called gods as the immortals, also called them the giants and so on, they were really not immortal, but their extremely long life in the eyes of the Sumerians or of mankind was really not that long. Now, could they live in their terms 100 years or 120 or 200 years? Now, you know that in the Old Testament, mortals, men who were closer genetically to the time when that genetic manipulation had taken place, lived much longer. There's the mention of Methuselah in the Bible. There's the mention of Enoch, who lived 365 years until he was taken aloft and never really died on earth. So the answer to your first question is yes, they could be on earth those fantastically long times as far as we count the years, but to them there were just so many few of their years.
I think another thing to bring in, and you've mentioned it there, is that they were masters of genetic engineering.
Yes.
And if they can do that, make a Neanderthal woman what we are today, they certainly could use that genetic engineering on themselves to extend life.
There are tales, Bill, that speak of their reviving the dead. There is a tale of the goddess Ishtar who died and through radiation was revived,
mm-hmm.
and so on. Now, the second part of your question...
Can you hold on to it? While I do the second part of this over here, and Barbara, you stay right there, and Zachariah will answer the second part of your question. Here, Barbara.
Well, the second part, Barbara, of your question was...
Oh, my name is Carol, and I have written to you, so I would like to be known as Carol.
Oh.
Sorry?
Okay.
My computer said Barbara. Sorry.
All right.
Well, go ahead.
Are you sure you're Carol?
Yes.
Okay. The second part of your question was, are they still here, or if not, will they come back? And this is something I really am disinclined to discuss at this point, because I'm answering those questions in my next book. And I'd like people to buy it and to read it, so you'll have to forgive me, but I would prefer not to answer.
Okay.
All right, now you've...
Thank you very much.
You've got something to hang your hat on there.
Yeah.
And look for the sequel to The Wars of Gods and Men, which has been published by Avon, which is one of our largest paperback publishers. The books are available just about everywhere. And while you're in there, you may want to ask for Stairway to Heaven and certainly the 12th Planet, the two previous books that Zachariah has written, and I will guarantee you they'll hold you spellbound all the way through. And we want to hold you spellbound for another hour, if we may. And we're talking about some fascinating stuff that comes out of the ancient writings of the ancient Sumerians about a group of celestials who came here, started the whole thing, and even gave us our first nuclear war. We'll find out more about that in this next hour. You're invited to come in and listen to Zachariah Sitchin. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. And just to kind of update you in case you just tuned in late, Zachariah's latest of his series of books is called The Gods of Wars of Men. It's available on Avon. It's in paperback. It's everywhere. And he is dealing with information that didn't come out of his mind other than the research that he did into the ancient Sumerian writings. And those ancient writers that go back thousands of years are telling us an incredible tale of a group of people who came here from another planet, one that swings widely in the system of planets that we live in, gets into our area about every 3,600 years, and when it's in close proximity to Earth, they started visiting Earth in these, in its wild swings, these elliptical swings, caused our civilization to begin, not only in its physical manifestations and what we are and what we look like, but our society as well. Had wars because of us and the planets, and we have carried on. We have carried on in that tradition, unfortunately. Zachariah Sitchin. Zachariah, welcome to Hour 3. And they gave us our first nuclear war.
Right.
2024 B.C. The simple point of that was a spaceport in what is now the Sinai Peninsula.
Right.
And the area around the Sinai Peninsula there certainly looks like it had been into some kind of war, doesn't it?
It does. There's a tremendous crater left there, and there's been no explanations for it hitherto, and I think I'm offering the only plausible one.
But it's not an explanation that came out of just your imagination. It's in the ancient writings.
It's in the ancient writings, and it's in NASA photographs from space.
It's amazing to me that those old writers should know about nuclear bombs, spaceports, spaceships, genetic engineering, and the list of technological wonders that they knew about then is staggering.
Well, it's amazing, one word to use. Others are less generous, Bill. They say incredible.
Well, incredible means not to be believed, and I try to stay away from that word
right.
as much as possible, because I think that what you have written is something that is worthy of looking at it and makes more sense than anything else we have seen. I just don't believe that those old writers were anything other than historians.
I think so too. As a matter of fact, Bill, I would not have written my books and certainly not have allowed them to be published before I myself was absolutely convinced beyond any doubt that those texts are telling us the facts, that this is not mythology, this is not fantasy, this is not imagination. These are facts that we read in those ancient texts, what really happened in ancient times in prehistory. There's no doubt in my mind about it.
And they were telling that story at least to the best of their ability. And they give us characters, a cast of characters. They give us stories that would make a magnificent motion picture, but it would be one that has a lot of historical validity to it. And if you'd like to talk to Zachariah during this last hour, let me give you the numbers. All of our numbers end in talk. In Los Angeles, 520. In the San Fernando Valley, 990. In Orange.
Oh, Bill, I'm glad that this is Ivan, the Stillmore Wind Turbine Man, and I'm really glad that you finally had Zachariah Sitchin on as your personal guest. I've heard you talk to him on the phone, but I think this is the first time he's been a personal guest, isn't it?
That's true.
Mr. Sitchin, I've read both of your prior books, and one question I'd like to ask is about... The Smithsonian Magazine recently had an article about Platonics and the theory. And I would like you to comment on, would the results of the collision that you talk about in your books that occurred with the Earth, and the Earth is a result, with the asteroid belt, which was called the bracelet and so forth,
yes.
After the collision, would not there have been a logically... rearrangement of the landmass just to achieve balance, which would have given rise to the Platonic theory?
Yeah, you're talking about our Earth, right? About our planet.
Right.
Right. Now, obviously, that is what happened because according to the Sumerian cosmological views that are expressed in detail in a what was scholars called poem or the Epic of Creation, the ancient name was Enuma Elish. It's a well-known translated text, not made up by me, which describes how the whole solar system was created, describes the invasion of the solar system by the planet from outer space that the Sumerians called Nibiru and the Babylonians later, in honor of their supreme god Marduk, how it was drawn into the solar system, how it collided with an ancient, one of the earliest planets in our solar system, which was called Tiamat, meaning mother of life.
Mm-hmm.
And Earth is just
a remnant
that is half of that planet. Now, so you can, or you should visualize, and I have the actual sketch of it, one of the few drawn by me and not from actual archaeological discoveries. I show a sketch of the half planet, which became the Earth, being thrusted through the collision, the force of the collision, to a new orbit,
mm-hmm.
which is our present orbit. So you have a planet, a half planet, so obviously the landmass is on one side. Tiamat has been described in the Sumerian writings as a watery planet, so we have also inherited the water, and now you have a planet that through its constant revolution and through the gravitational forces in the solar system gradually becomes a globe. From a half orange becomes a full orange.
Yeah, it would rebalance itself.
Right, so it rebalances itself. We still have on one side the tremendous cavity filled with water, which is the Pacific Basin,
mm-hmm.
a tremendously deep cavity. And you had on the other opposite side all the landmass or the continents. Now as the planet keeps revolving and revolving and gets its global shape of a globe with all the gravitational forces working on it, gradually the landmass begins to spread and spread. And this is the Platonic theory, except that no one of those who developed or wrote about the Platonic or suggested the Platonic theory could explain why to begin with was the landmass only in one spot. The Sumerians 6,000 years ago did.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't explain why we have the moon in such a perfect, very unnatural orbit as we see things. Just a circle.
Well, the moon bill, according to the same cosmological text, Enuma Elish, was one of about a dozen satellites of Tiamat, the planet that was broken up. And it was, which brings us to something I mentioned at the beginning of the evening, which was in the process of separating from the gravitational influence of Tiamat and becoming a planet in its own right, just as Pluto had become sometime later. That process was interrupted by the celestial collision with the invader, with Nibiru or Marduk in its Babylonian name. When the Earth, the half of Tiamat, was shunted to a new orbit, it pulled that large satellite with it, and thus has the moon, which was about to become a planet in its own right, thus it has become a satellite, so to say, of the Earth, which is the olden Tiamat or part of it. And this is why, as I said at the beginning of the evening, why the Sumerians considered the moon a celestial body in its own right,
mm-hmm.
whereas, say, the satellites orbiting Jupiter or Saturn don't count in the number 12.
You know, one of the things that comes to my mind, and we've had discussions about it before, is the unusual orbit of the moon around the Earth. That's almost a perfect circle. You don't see that usually in orbiting bodies. They're elliptical.
Right.
And the rotation of the moon on its axis is such that it doesn't vary as far as
how much space the Earth, right?
Almost as if it was engineered.
Well, they're almost like twins. In other words, they come from the same place, another place in the heavens. They were thrust and shunted together, and they have remained in this synchronization ever since.
Well, you know, it's interesting if we were just a half a planet at one time. Excuse me, Ivan, this second, I'll get back to you.
Okay.
The old stories about how you could fall off the edge of the Earth may have been true.
Well, yeah. If you could fight off gravity, you would.
Yeah, Ivan, go ahead.
Mr. Sitchin, about a year or so ago, there was an article from the Naval Observatory that indicated that they felt that there was another large planet out there that was approaching. Could this be the approach of our planet that is the main story in your book?
Yes, I believe so. I've been in touch with the chiefs of the group at the U.S. Naval Observatory ever since they concluded originally that Pluto has a moon, a satellite, which led them to the conclusion that there must be another celestial body beyond Pluto. And just to give you one sentence from what they've been telling me and writing me is they said, let us catch up with the Sumerian knowledge.
Well, that's very, very interesting.
So we may have a celestial visitor here in the not-too-distant future.
Well, I wanted to ask him what year, but he said that was going to be in his next book, so I won't ask him.
Right.
But Dr. Beck has referred one time to a book that he read that was titled Pharaoh's Pump. And this is not necessarily Dr. Beck's theory, but he said that the people in there put up a good proposition that the pyramids were actually pumps that raised the Nile water up to a higher level where they could irrigate. Have you run across anything similar to this, Mr. Sitchin, in any of your studies?
Well, this was brought to my attention, and I really cannot explain or speculate on somebody else's theories.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, I'm going to look forward to seeing you tomorrow because I'm certainly going to try to be there.
Thank you.
Ivan, when I was going down 210 the other day, your windmill didn't look like it was jimmying.
Oh, well, it should have been if the wind was blowing.
Oh, all right. I just want to make sure it was working all right.
But someday you're going to stop by and see me, right?
That's right.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Ivan.
Thank you very much. Bye.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. High and 70 feet wide are so clear and the impact so great, you'll think you're actually attempting aerial maneuvers with the Blue Angels and being pursued by police during a thrilling high-speed chase. Experience a movie today at the new California Museum of Science and Industries IMAX Theater. Call area code 213-744-2015. And are you a woman? And Bill Jenkins with me in studio, Zachariah Sitchin. And we have on the line William. Are you there?
Are you talking to me, Bill?
I'm talking to... Oh, this is Craig. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, Craig, you're on TV. There you are. Hello, Craig.
Hi, Bill.
Craig calls us from time to time, Zachariah, from way up north in California, to rig his radio in such a strange kind of way to hear our little signal.
Yeah, it's hard.
I hope you're enjoying the show tonight.
I've been trying to. I missed some of the details. So, in fact, I was going to say it's going to be real hard for me to talk about the details of what you're presenting here. First of all, the whole time you've been on tonight, I've been thinking about Emanuel Velikovsky. And actually, I'm surprised nobody else has mentioned it. I'm sure you're familiar with his books.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering, I noted some differences. What would you have to say in general about what he has to say and the differences with what you have to say?
Well, there are many similarities between us. He wrote, of course, many years before my books began to be published. And what he has done is he referred to biblical sources. He referred to Egyptian sources. For some reason, of which I'm not aware, He had no access. I think maybe he just didn't know those languages that I've studied. He had no access to the Mesopotamian, Sumerian, Akkadian, Babylonian sources. I don't recall in his books any reference at all to those sources, although they, as scholars now know and acknowledge, they are really the original sources of both the biblical, the Egyptian, and other tales, mythologies, or whatever one prefers to call them. So this is one difference or flaw in his writings. But he did go to the biblical and Egyptian, I think also some Greek sources, and he found in them references to a celestial collision. And he, thinking what it meant, concluded that there was some collision in rather recent, or we could say historical times, biblical times, that led to the creation of Venus. That Venus, he said, was a comet that was caught, orbited, was drawn into the solar system, and so on. Now, all that was very interesting, except I think he was wrong in his conclusion. Because where were he to be aware, I'm sorry, of the Sumerian, Mesopotamian sources, he would have known, first of all, that Venus was one of the originally created planets in our system that were created in pairs.
Right, and it was already recognized. Right?
And it was already recognized, say, by the Sumerians. And two, that it's true that the ancient sources speak of a celestial collision, speak of an invader from outer space that was caught into constant or perpetual orbit. But that is the planet that I call the 12th planet, and that the Sumerians called Nibiru, the Babylonians Marduk. So, while he has done a lot of research and reached, to some extent, the same evidence, the same sources that I did, he stopped short. He had no access, perhaps, to the additional information, the additional sources that I had, or that I had access to. And thus, in my opinion, he reached the wrong conclusion.
Did you ever have a chance to speak with him or correspond with him before he died?
I was supposed to have met him, but he was quite sick by then, and we ended up not meeting.
Okay, well, let me move on to some questions here. I personally don't rule things out of hand, you know, as being impossible. I mean, there's a lot of things about the past we just don't know. And there are a lot of people who talk about the possible existence of a 10th planet and many other things. I have, to begin with, one real great difficulty with what you're presenting. And very simply, if there's an advanced species of life, a sentient life, that has adapted to living on a planet with an orbit such as you describe, I don't know how they would be able to survive on a planet such as Earth.
Why not?
Well, the conditions are so drastically different.
In what way?
You want me to point out all the ways I can think of?
By all means. Otherwise, how could I answer your question?
Well, okay. Tell me one thing. How close in does this putative planet come in its orbit?
It passes between Mars and Jupiter.
Okay. So that's its closest point. And,
right.
And the furthest point?
Well, it has an orbit of 3,600 years, so you can figure it out.
Well...
it's far out, right?
Yeah, quite. How many astronomical units are we talking about?
Well, I have calculations, but... For the average listener, it's far out.
Right? Two or three times the orbit of Pluto, or what?
What's the difference?
Well, okay.
It's very far out, right?
Fine.
It's far out.
In any event, for any kind of life to adapt to changes in the radiative heat that they're receiving from the sun, for instance, that are so great between the two extremes of its orbit, you know, I wouldn't know how to conjecture what form that type of life would take. But then to suppose that life form adapted to those extreme conditions could then successfully survive on planet Earth, And our orbit is much closer, of course, than the asteroid belt. And we have a pretty stable, fairly regular orbit. It's really kind of hard to believe.
Well, they also have a fairly regular orbit. Like us, they have a summer and a winter. When they are out there, it's winter, and when they are nearer the sun, it's summer. And as I was telling a previous caller, to them, one orbit is 1 year. So they had 6 months winter and 6 months summer, and probably some spring and autumn in between. Except that to us, one of their years is 3,600 years. To us, their orbit seems an incredible orbit. But to them, probably the orbit of the Earth looks like a minor or relatively minute orbit.
When they're out so, that far, they really have winter.
But they did not depend. They did not depend on heat from the sun, because the Sumerians described that planet in text and pictorially as a radiating planet, a planet that had its own heat. Like, well, you know, in the neighborhood of Jupiter radiates more heat than it gets. But you know that in the neighborhood of Jupiter, they discovered sources of heat 2.5 times stronger than the heat emanated by the sun.
Well, then, okay.
So the whole notion that the planet cannot have heat unless it's near the sun has been discarded by now.
Yes, I realize that. And if there's a life form living on such a planet with an orbit such as you describe, again, I don't see how they could successfully thrive on a planet like Earth. When we talk about colonizing or in any sense setting up colonies, you know, small scale colonies on planets out in the solar system, we talk in terms of enclosed, say dome like structures or something. We bring our atmosphere. We create all sorts of modifications just to be able to survive, let alone thrive.
Well,
we
do that simply because the atmospheres to which we are used or that we need are either on those other planets are totally different or because they don't exist. For example, there's no atmosphere on the moon. There's a thin atmosphere on Mars. I believe there was an even better or greater atmosphere on Mars that probably dissipated in time, but some still left. So there are all kinds of theories that, for example, even on planets that we think have no oxygen or not sufficient oxygen, there's really enough oxygen in the form of CO2. So we're really going into very sophisticated scientific theories.
In a way, Craig, it sounds like if they come to Earth, it's like going to a South Sea island where the weather is very warm and balmy, as far as I'm concerned.
I think the answer to your question really lies in what I consider to be the basic question, and that is, in view of all the knowledge that the Sumerians had 6,000 years ago, knowledge of astronomy and other sciences, how could they have known all that unless what they said, that those who had come from that planet told them, unless that is the answer, then there's no explanation.
Well, I'm sure.
So you're always back to the basic question.
I don't know enough about it to provide the explanation for that, but what I'm saying is I find the theory that you've proposed more than difficult to swallow. We still haven't even. I don't know if you do this in your books, but do you attempt any explanation for how an advanced life form adapts to such a planet?
Do you mean to tell me you are the only one in this country who hasn't read my books?
Sorry to say, I must be.
Well, I think that Bill Jenkins will invite me again next year, and after you read the books, ask me again questions. I'm sure you'll find some answers in the books.
Well, do you actually discuss this specific question?
Well, I discuss it in various aspects, scientifically and from those texts. I don't know if I answer every question the way you phrase it, but I do answer the
question. I think the main thing to remember, Craig, is that he is just now giving you the information that the Sumerians had written down. and sort of putting in a language that we can understand, and information that is already there, and information that is proven to be very, very accurate in the past as far as the descriptions of things that are going on. So it's not that he's conjured up a theory or a hypothesis, but rather he is repeating what has been told to us by ancient historians.
Well, okay. in many points, I'm sure that's the case. But in the final, I don't know how to put this.
I know how to put it. I'm going to have to go to a commercial.
Yeah, I know that.
Okay, Craig.
Well, I can't say I can go along with it.
Okay, well, I do.
Okay. But I appreciate the chance to talk to you.
All right. Thank you for taking all the trouble to listen way up there. I know it's difficult.
Okay.
Okay, Sitchin. And we are now going to talk to William. William?
Hi, it's good to be on with you, Zachary. I wanted to ask you, what year did you say they had come down to try to obtain the gold from the seas there in the Mediterranean area?
About 450,000 years ago, give or take.
Give or take a few months, yeah.
Okay. Also, I wanted to ask you, in your new book, which, do you happen to know what the title is going to be of the sequel?
Yes.
Okay. In there, do you sort of draw any conclusions as to what the encounter will be when that planet comes into our solar system? Is there sentient life there now? Is that discussed at all?
Well, we have both Mesopotamian and even biblical texts dealing with what happens on Earth when quakes and other natural phenomena, night turning into day, day turning into night, and so on. In general, the biblical texts and the Sumerian, Mesopotamian, Babylonian omen texts, as they are called, consider that time, which, by the way, doesn't last a month or a year, but can last hundreds of years, as a time where mankind itself, as a result of the nearing of that planet and as a result of the natural catastrophes, will also be in turmoil. But that will be followed, according to the biblical prophetic text, by a time of peace, of nation living with nation, of, to refer to the title of the third book, The Wars of Gods and Men, as a time when men will transform their weapons into plows, into tools of peace. So a time of upheavals, natural, human, followed by peace, prosperity, goodwill, or in the language of the New Testament, the return of the kingdom of heaven to earth.
Okay, you said that they were here 440,000 years ago. Is that the last time they were here, or have they been here more recently?
Oh, no, they were coming and going every 3,600 years.
What was about the most recent time they've been here?
Well, if I answered that, you'll figure out when they're coming again, so...
Oh.
That's the one question I keep avoiding answering.
Okay.
I know, I tried to ask him that last time he was on, and I got nowhere with that. And I didn't think we would this time. But you know that it's less than 3,600 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you probably can do a little bit of math and kind of scoot it down to yourself. It might get interesting here in the not-too-distant future.
Interesting. As I said, I wanted to point out, because that's based on questions asked.
Well, the reason I had said that was because you had mentioned Abraham, which... I think you had said it was like 4,000 years ago.
Right.
And apparently they were here then.
Right.
Okay.
Math gets awfully close whenever you bring Abraham into it, doesn't
really?
It?
Really? Okay.
All right.
Well, I'll be looking forward to both of your new books then.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
appreciate your call, William. Okay, Dorothy, it's your turn.
Yes, Bill, hello.
Hi.
This is the Dorothy you know from Santa Monica. You've got a 5-star program tonight, I have to say.
Well, thank you very much.
Yes, I was really surprised to get on. I wanted to ask you, Bill, how the in regard to the genetic engineering that was accomplished in the Sinai Peninsula or in that area there, how does that tie in with Drs. Vivian and Lee Gladden's book, Their Heirs to the Gods, with which you're familiar? I don't know if Zachariah is familiar with that work.
No, I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there certainly is a tie-in. Their work comes out of the etymology of the Bible, whereas in Genesis they talk about the engineering of the DNA molecule of the celestials themselves and the indigenous primates that were living here at the time. And they literally replicated the new human being, which we may refer to as Adam and Eve, and the story goes on. There's a great deal of similarity in the Sumerian writings and that Lee and Vivian found dealing just with the Bible.
Yes, well, with the Gladden's book, though, I understand that their celestials were to come from the constellation Bootes.
That's right, in a planet that was in orbit around Arcturus, named Maseroth.
Well, it's occurred to me that we have had a tremendous dearth of information in a black hole in our studies and our information for the past 2,000 years or so, or more than that. We have a lot of time to make up and a lot of studies to go into, since the ancients seem to have it way ahead of us at this point. But I certainly have enjoyed getting on and talking with you, Bill, and looking forward to getting out to the bookstore tomorrow to get those books.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Sure.
Appreciate it very much.
Right.
I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, Zachariah Sitchin. It's Open Mind. Like, to me, you just sat down, Zachariah. And here it's about time for you to get up. So we'll get on with getting to as many as we can here tonight. Bob, you're on.
Hi, Zachariah. I'm very impressed with your rational type of explanations, except with certain exceptions. I tend to agree with Craig on the uniqueness of a planet with a 3,600-year orbit and what life would be like and how it would be adaptable to Earth. But it's also very interesting to find the use of the most heat-reflective material we've got is finely divided gold, or gold is actually the most reflective material.
Isn't that fascinating that the Sumerians will even know about the properties of gold that are attributed to the science of our time?
Well, it is, except that you not only keeps heat from getting out, it keeps heat from getting in. And
but it also responds to electromagnetics in a very unusual
that
way.
That means that their summers were not were not too hot then. Maybe Los Angeles could use such a system.
It might change things quite... Well, we would definitely keep heat in, so you don't really know what would happen. However, I do definitely believe at that period, in those periods of time, we've had near planetary collisions. I would tend to think an orbit of a planet like that would tend to even itself out, just like the Earth evened itself out, having been split, according to your theory. I also believe that in this accident, we depressurized the Earth, which is why so much of the earlier life was destroyed. The bigger animals could not sustain the oxygen levels they needed. And the crate took away all my power. And I hope you're hearing that, Craig.
Yeah.
No, but that's a good question about, you know, how's you going to live without sun? Because obviously it's many astrological units out there in its darkest winter, but it's just winter to them.
Well,
right?
I understand that, everything does tend to fall in place if the planet has internal heat and you are reflecting it, and also gold becomes a light reflector, so any energy that they would be lighting their planet with would be reflecting. And I don't necessarily think that, and when you read some of these earlier works, that every description as we translate them or as we comprehend them tends to be exactly correct, because sometimes the words were missing. But I certainly think that there's an awful lot there. I mean, it's in the Bible, and it's in everything that von Daniken says tends to be at times. I haven't read your stuff, but that's going to be rectified very fast.
Yes, thank you.
Exactly.
Thank you.
But I believe that, like, von Daniken tends to be a very irrational present very irrational arguments along with a whole bunch of very rational ones. And some of it is because the information we get is very sketchy, and some of it is because the opposition of so-called scientific communities can only understand the status quo.
They like it the way it is. That keeps their grants going. Don't trouble the waters.
Okay, but thank you very much.
All right, Bob. Thank you for joining us here. And I'm sorry, Craig took away all your power there. Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, bye-bye. All right, Joanne, you're on.
Yes, Bill. Like everyone else, I feel that tonight's show is particularly interesting.
Thank you.
I have two questions for Mr. Sitchin, and they're unrelated. First of all, could you please explain the origin of the different races on Earth?
The origin of the different races.
I hope the second one is easier.
Yes, it is.
Well, do you want to tackle that one or go with the second?
No, let's hear the second one.
All right, that is, why did they feel that gold was in the Persian Gulf?
Well, as I said, maybe too quickly in passing, at the beginning of tonight's show.
I possibly missed that.
Yes. The first one to have come to Earth was a ruler who was deposed on their planet, who escaped to Earth in a spaceship, and had time to explore Earth. Now, all seawater, by the way, has a certain amount of gold in it, and the Persian Gulf is even richer than others. Now, you do need a very sophisticated, elegant way of extracting those small, minute percentages of gold in the water to extract it, but it could be done, and they obviously had sophisticated methods if they could travel in space almost 500,000 years ago.
I see. Thank
you. So that is... Now, the origin of races, the Bible tells us in chapter 10 of Genesis about the so-called Table of Nations, all the nations that developed out of the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, the names have a meaning, by the way, which can explain or throw more light on as an answer to your question. Shem meant a spacecraft and a rocket ship. And the lands of Shem were the lands where the spaceport, mission control center, and so on were located. Ham meant the one who comes from the hot areas or the one whose skin is brown. And Japheth meant the one who is fair-skinned. So according to those notions, the three races of mankind developed out of the remnants of mankind that stayed after the great flood or the deluge.
I see.
Does that help you, Joanne?
Yes, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the questions. They were good ones.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Jenkins with Zachariah Sitchin. You have just a few short moments, so make your question real, real quick, if you will.
Yes, Bill. Uh-huh. Mr. Sitchin.
Yes.
I'm definitely going to read your books.
Thank you.
A very informative evening. I'd like to know, on the basis of your studying the ancient texts, if you feel that the UFO sightings may have something to do with perhaps the people who are our benefactors are something similar to that.
Well, I myself have not seen a UFO.
Well, I have.
You have. Okay, so you know on that subject from the current point of view more than me. But when the subject of UFOs is raised with me, and since I'm a biblical scholar and student of ancient times, I tell usually people that... since we are running out of time, I'll make it short. The story of Jacob, the so-called Jacob's dream, is really a story of his seeing a UFO, what we would call today UFO. So my answer is, if one believes in the Bible, one has to believe in UFOs.
Very good.
Okay, did that
thank
happen?
You.
All right, Joseph, thank you for your question. I'm glad we could get you in. And I'm sorry we can't get the rest of you in, but our time has done us in. But you will have a chance if you want to tomorrow. Zachariah will be talking with Elizabeth Clare Prophet about his discoveries at 3 p.m., and she's well up on Zachariah's work at the Summit University tomorrow. That's at 26800 West Mulholland Highway out in Calabasas. Be there if you want to hear more about Mr. Sitchin's fascinating reports. The admission is $5, and you can call 818-880-5300 and find out more about that appearance tomorrow. The book is The Wars of Gods and Men. It's done by Avon Books, available everywhere. Zachariah, thank you for flying in from New York to be with us tonight. It's been one of our most fascinating
days. Bill, it was my pleasure.
And anytime you're back on the West Coast, you get in that chair.
Okay.
Is that a promise?
Well, it's a hot seat.
All right. In 2 weeks, Tom Bearden will be here on Weather Wars. We seem to be in one. You'll get the story then. See you then. Night.